IELTS Listening Practice Tests by IELTS Success Group. Copyright 2021. This material may not be copied. IELTS Listening Practice Test 3. Section 1.
Hi, I was wondering if you could help me.
Well, let's see, what's your question?
Well, I just registered for classes on Thursday last week, and I received my computer ID and password yesterday, but when I try and log on to the computer system on campus, I keep getting an error message.
Oh, okay. Do you remember what the message says?
No, unfortunately I don't. It just gives me a message saying I can't log in.
Have you got your ID and password with you?
No, but I know them by heart.
Okay, great. Why don't you try to log on to this computer right here, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, here goes. There, the message I keep getting. Do you see it? It says something about invalid password characters.
Right. That's a common problem students experience. You see, there are certain characters and symbols that you can't use in your password. Things like the slash, the question mark, and the number sign, for example.
Oh, well, why is that?
Those kinds of symbols are forbidden for passwords because the computer uses them in mathematical calculations. Have you tried to use any symbol like that in your password?
Yeah, I have, but I didn't realize that I wasn't supposed to.
Well, it's all explained on page 39. In your student handbook, so...
Oh, right, I get it. It was my responsibility to read that. But, you know, I was just so tired after all I'd registered that I didn't really have the energy to read the handbook all the way through.
No problem. Actually, we're used to that. I mean, we hear that a lot.
So what can we do now to solve the problem?
It should be pretty easy to solve, actually. You just need to press Ctrl-Alt-Delete, and then the system will ask you to change your password. So then, you should type in a new one that doesn't have one of those forbidden characters in it. Of course, I'm sure I don't need to remind you to choose a password that you can remember.
Sure. Can I change it now and see what happens?
Please do. That's a good idea.
Okay, let me try this. Okay, I put the new one in now. The system seems to have accepted it. Can I try logging in again?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, there's my ID now. The new password. Great, I'm in. Thanks so much for your help.
That is the end of Section 1. Section 2.
So today we're going to talk about good nutrition. Now, everybody knows that good nutrition is essential for good health. Indeed, a healthy diet can help a person to maintain a good body weight, promote mental well-being, and even reduce the risk of disease. So, first of all today, we are going to look at the answer to the question, what does healthy nutrition consist of? Well, really, a healthy diet should include food from four major groups. These four groups are carbohydrate, fruit, vegetables, and protein. The first of the four groups, carbohydrate, includes food like potatoes, bread, and cereals. Although carbohydrates seem to have gotten bad press lately, in fact they are an essential part of healthy nutrition. Because, well, importantly, they provide the building blocks for supplying energy to the body. The second and third food groups are fruit and vegetables, although some people would just include these as one group. This may be easy to understand at first blush, but it's worth pointing out that good nutrition depends on eating a variety of fruit and vegetables. While the old adage, "an apple a day keeps the doctor away," may appear to be sound advice, eating the same fruit or vegetables daily, it's not really the best advice in reality. The amount of fruit and vegetables, now that's also important to bear in mind, Most medical practitioners in the United States now recommend a minimum consumption of 5 portions of fruit or vegetables every day. Now, protein includes foods such as meat and fish, as well as dairy products like milk and cheese. However, lean protein is better than fatty protein, so it's best to limit the consumption of red meat, rich cheeses, and cream. In addition to keeping an eye on fat intake, the amount of sugar a person eats should also be moderated. I want to ask at this point, do you think that it's better to give up sugar completely in order to achieve optimal health?
I don't think a person should try to forgo sweets altogether. It's just that consuming too much sugar is often connected to health problems later in life, like type 2 diabetes. So I think the thing is to try to be careful not to eat too much sugar.
Yes, that's right. Like the old saying goes, everything in moderation. Next, let's move on and look at the health risks posed by processed or convenience food. Of course, fresh food is far better than processed food. Packaged food often contains chemicals such as additives to enhance the color of the food, or preservatives that give the food a longer life. These chemicals aren't good for your health for a number of reasons. First of all, they aren't natural, and may perhaps be linked to disease in the long term. And in addition, they may block the body's ability to absorb energy and nutrients from food, with nutrients being the essential vitamins and minerals that are required for a healthy bodily function. Finally, let's have a look at nutritional requirements for adults. Here, by adult, I mean people from 19 to 50 years of age. Now let's think about this for a moment. Do you think that energy requirements, I mean in the terms of the number of calories consumed, do you think they are higher for teenagers or adults?
Isn't it true that teenagers would probably need more calories than adults? Because, I mean, teenagers are still in their growing phase, aren't they?
Yes, it's absolutely true that compared to children and teenagers, energy requirements for adults are lower for both men and women. Nevertheless, to the nutritional requirements for vitamins and minerals for adults remain unchanged compared to teenage years. Of course, women experience increased nutritional requirements during pregnancy.
That is the end of Section 2. Section 3.
Good afternoon, everyone. In our seminar today, we're going to be discussing educational strategies. Since all of you are studying education and are going to be teachers yourselves one day, I'm sure you can appreciate that this is a very worthwhile topic for discussion. It goes without saying that I hope everyone has read the background reading for today. Now, of course, as teachers, you'll be able to use a very wide variety of assessment models. So, let's look at the first type of assessment that we're going to discuss, the student readiness model. So, what do we mean by the student readiness model? Well, as teachers, you'll quickly realize that students are individuals, each operating at different levels of ability. For some students, this might mean that they are operating above the average ability level of their contemporaries, while for others, they may be functioning at a level that is below average. Then, too, there are the students who are in what can be called a comfort zone. These students are learning at the optimum learning level. They're being challenged and learning new things, but yet they don't feel overwhelmed or inundated by the new information. Okay, just to complicate things, we also have to remember that student readiness is not a static entity. In other words, it is constantly changing. Some students will become more confident throughout the semester and will be able to increase their student readiness. And unfortunately, other students may fall behind and might slip to a below-average position. Therefore, the onus falls on us as teachers not only to work out how best to design the curriculum, but also how to structure classroom learning activities that are going to challenge the maximum amount of students. As you will have discovered in your reading for today, the strategy of question adjustment can be deployed to help bridge the gap between those students with low readiness and those with high readiness. Now, based on the reading, who can explain the concept of question adjustment?
Well, if I have understood the reading for today correctly, question adjustment means that the teacher will ask questions at a variety of different levels of difficulty. There will be some so-called easy questions to build the confidence of the students who are less ready, and then there will also be some really difficult questions which are supposed to stretch the more capable students who are the most ready. Did I get that right?
Yes, that's perfect. Now, can you expand on that point? I'm thinking here about learning materials that can be used in the classroom in order to achieve question adjustment.
I think I'm with you. Are you alluding to what they said in the book about posters? The thing about putting up posters in the classroom with some of the questions on them, and making sure that each poster has a question of a different level of difficulty.
Yes, I can see that you're really very well prepared for today's discussion. Great. Now, let's move on to the area of formal assessment. In other words, quizzes and tests and so on. Now, of course, we should distinguish here between formal and informal. Can anyone explain the difference?
The formal ones are those that count towards the mark or grade for the course, but the informal ones don't.
Fantastic. So, as I'm sure you know, the purpose of giving the informal assessment is, again, to help build student confidence. Readiness begets confidence, but conversely, confidence can also help to improve a student's level of readiness.
That is the end of Section 3. Section 4.
Antarctica is a mysterious and resilient continent that is often forgotten by virtue of its geographical location. Indeed, the Antarctic is remote and desolate. Nevertheless, an understanding of this continent is critical to our comprehension of the world as a global community. For this reason, the southernmost continent has been the source of a great deal of scientific investigation. Scientists who have explored this barren land have come from around the world. In 1907, Ernest Shackleton led one of the first expeditions in this area. One of the groups under his supervision was the first to summit Mount Erebus. Shackleton and three other members of his team made several records in the three-month period from December 1908 to February 1909. They were the first human beings to travel across the Transantarctic mountain range, as well as the first to reach the South Polar Plateau. In December 1911, Roald Amundsen, a Norwegian explorer, was the first to reach the geographic South Pole, having journeyed by the Bay of Whales and the Axel Heiberg Glacier. Richard Evelyn Byrd also led several explorations of the Antarctic by air throughout the 1930s and 1940s. He then implemented land transport and conducted biological and geographical studies. Later, on October 31, 1956, an expedition led by Rear Admiral George Dufek of the United States Navy successfully landed an airplane on the continent. In addition, much notable recent research has come from America and Great Britain. This corpus of research has resulted in an abundance of factual data on the Antarctic. Containing nearly 70% of the world's fresh water supply, Antarctica plays a crucial role in the world's ecosphere. Therefore, the Antarctic is also a key factor in current global climate change. On its surface, it possesses a 4-kilometer-thick ice sheet. This mammoth sheet of ice atrophies because of year-round melting at its base, as well as the loss of ice due to the formation of icebergs. However, the ice sheet is also perpetually replenished by snowfall and frost. At present, two methodologies are employed to measure the size of the ice sheet. The first is the accumulation method, by which the difference between the loss of ice and the accumulation of new precipitation is calculated. The second technique, known as the direct measurement approach, involves the use of satellites to determine whether the ice sheet is growing thicker. Yet, unfortunately, both methods have a rather large potential for error. The measurement of the ice sheet is of paramount importance because scientists fear that the melting of a large amount of the ice sheet may occur as a result of global warming. Some believe that human beings are directly responsible for any potential ecological catastrophe, pointing to their excessive reliance on fossil fuels for domestic use and transportation. On the other hand, some assert that natural causes also have a part to play in the debacle, especially volcanic eruptions. While there are some uncertainties about the phenomenon of global warming, it is indisputable that the current rate of sea level change is unprecedented.
That is the end of Section 4. That is the end of IELTS Listening Practice Test 3.